This episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you in part by Carolyn. You can become a Blotter Presents tipster at patreon.com/blotterpresents. And now, on with the episode.
I had no idea what I was doing. And I had no idea who I was dealing with. But I knew
it was a hell of a story.
Mid-70s saw the births of two cultural phenomena. One, the overdue realization by law enforcement that serial killers existed, quote, thanks to the work of one Theodore Robert Bundy, and the cottage industry of commentary that sprung up around him, his escape attempts, and the center part style and VW bug he ruined for everyone else. The other phenomenon, Saturday Night Live, whose brightest, or loudest anyway, inaugural cast, Light, John Belushi, succumbed to a speedball overdose in 1982 that had friends, family, and the LAPD looking for someone besides Belushi to blame. This meeting of the Carol DeRanche Admiration Society is hereby called to order for The Blotter Presents, Episode 82. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast examining the idea that while crime is bad, some of the stories about crime can be pretty good. My guest and I met at Yahoo Shine, where I lent her a book about Robert Chambers on our second day of training. For some reason, she's still talking to me. Her book, You All Grow Up and Leave Me, lives at the crossroads of memoir and true crime, and I tore through it in a single plane ride. Piper Weiss, I am so glad I have finally gotten you on the podcast. Welcome.
Oh my God, Sarah, I am psyched to be here.
I am so glad. You suggested that we take a look at our most wanted topic this week, which is Conversations with a Killer, the Ted Bundy tapes. Here is the case file. We don't have all day, and listeners, you have not just arrived from a distant galaxy, so I will stick with the Netflix landing page copy, quote, present-day interviews, archival footage, and audio recordings made on death row form a searing portrait of notorious serial killer Ted Bundy. Bundy is the sine qua non of serial killers vis-a-vis our understanding of them today, I would say, and of many true crime mavens' interest in the genre, thanks to the book about him so many of us started on, that put true crime and her on the map. I'm talking about Anne Rule's The Stranger Beside Me, of course. As prolific as Anne Rule in the true crime TV documentary space is Joe Berlinger, who brings us Conversations with a Killer, the Ted Bundy tapes, which is premiering, somewhat tackily in my opinion, on the 30th anniversary of Bundy's execution. That's Thursday, January 24th on Netflix. Okay. So, before we get into this particular property, what made you select this particular thing for us to talk about on the podcast?
Oh, God. I mean, well, Anne Rule's book was like one of the original inspirations for the book that I ended up creating. Because it, you know, her book is definitely more true crime than memoir, but she, if you're not familiar with this, she worked with Bundy at a suicide hotline when she was a young mom. She was also writing true crime stories at the time. And she really believed that he was innocent for a long time. And so, you know, she unravels the truth and this investigation into Bundy, as both, you know, a kind of crime writer and investigator, but also as like a woman who was kind of taken by him. And, you know, at some point in the book, she said, I wanted my daughter to date him. So what really interested me always in Bundy is this idea that he was kind of like charming and quote unquote a catch, and how that let him kind of get away with a serial killer murder, you know?
Yeah.
And then, The other thing that I've been interested in for a while is just like, if you go to YouTube, there's like all these video tributes to him and, you know, like set to like Jim Morrison videos. Like he is this like cult hero.
Oh, God. And I will say that this series and my esteemed colleague and work wife, Tara Ariano, pointed out that there are kind of a lot of photos of him in this, in at least the trailer of this, where he's posed as though he's on the cover of like a soft rock album, just like with his arm yes. draped over his be blue jeaned knee, and he's like, it's WMST Moist FM, I'm your DJ Ted Bundy, I've got a killer playlist, like ooh. But the thing is, like, he was, you'll see this in the visual aids for this episode, which you can find on social media. That's at Blotter Presents on Facebook and Twitter. But there are a couple of still photos that they get of him in this series where he really does look unhinged. But
yeah.
That's pretty rare. Like, he just looked like this sort of soft rock kind of guy, which between that and like the fact that it was pre-internet and that assuming that someone was a serial killer, I think, is the default now. But that was not a thing for law enforcement. And it took the FBI profiling team kind of a long time to get this idea to have any currency that these guys exist and that they could look, they're not all going to look like whatever, Ed Gein or Edmund Kemper. Sometimes they're going to look like Ted Bundy. And it's going to be harder to believe. I have a couple of clips that I think represent one of the things I really liked about the Ted Bundy tapes, which is successfully conveying a sense of the time in which all of this was happening. So here is clip two, which I kind of want to make my ringtone, the 70s and angry era. Here we go.
The 70s. An angry era. Inflation. Vietnam. Watergate. Iran. Demonstrations and riots. The ripoff. The scam. The hustle. The cheat.
In the 70s, there is fear. Fear of crime in the streets. Violent crimes are up 130% in the last 10 years. Murder up 62%. Rape 116%.
In the 1970s, the phenomenon of serial murder was brand new and absolutely frightening.
And you have a couple of things going on in this clip. One of them is this music cue that harkens back to The Deliberate Stranger, which haunts me to this day. That is the miniseries starring Mark Harmon as Ted Bundy. And you also have this very economical and successful window into the reasons that, for example, my parents decided to start a family, looked at each other and were like, bye, and left New York City and went to Jersey. So there was definitely a sense, I think, at that time that the world was coming apart for various reasons. And I think this miniseries does a good job of putting you at that time.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it definitely captures that side of the 70s, which is kind of like in some ways creepier, but it's also like, it's also just like the spreading of coverage of things. I mean, suddenly there's like more footage of events. There's like more channels on television, more people have television.
Right.
So, you know, like the alarmist nature of things is, also spreading. You know, I think that's happening. And then you also have that, like, you know, reactionary to the, like, peace, love, hippie 1969 era, you know, that's already switched into, like, you know, from the Mansons and Altamont into, you know, the Patty Hearst stuff and all of these, like, fringe communes supposedly, you know, kind of going haywire.
Yeah. You also have, they talk a little bit in the second episode about the like underbelly, I guess, or the dark side of women's liberation. And this also is a pretty flavorful vintage clip in clip three.
Join us now. Sisterhood is powerful. The battle cry of the women's liberation movement rings out down New York's Fifth Avenue as more than 10,000 militant feminists stage a one-day strike for equal rights.
In the late 60s and 70s, the women's movement opened up a number of doors for women to have choices, to be whatever they wanted to be.
Equal rights to have a job, to have respect, to not be viewed as a piece of meat.
There was a lot more independence, a lot more empowerment.
This will continue as a political coalition to win the unfinished revolution of women's equality.
Women were a lot freer. Hitchhiking, for example, was not a big deal, but because there was more of an open society, new types of crimes against women became more common.
Yeah, the hitchhiking always kind of gets me, because there's when I used to do virtual true crime book club with a group of my friends, like the number of these books where hitchhiking figured heavily in the disappearances of girls and women. And I'm absolutely not victim blaming, but it's just like, I think that's another thing that Bundy ruined for everyone. Like, I just am trying to get a ride to Colorado, and now if someone stops in a VW bug, you can't. It's not safe. So,
his MO wasn't even like hitchhiking. It was all it was like classic Silence of the Lambs shit, where he was just like, "I hurt my arm. Can you help me lift this thing into my car?" That was like, he was actually like always kind of playing the vulnerable person, where you're just like, "Oh, it's just a handsome man in a turtleneck with a broken arm that needs my lady help."
Always with the turtleneck too. Why, Ted? Why?
Oh, love the turtleneck. But yeah. I thought that this, like, in terms of the film, like, I was disappointed that was really kind of like the only moment in the series that addressed what it meant to be a woman at that time, and as a result, like, what it meant to be a survivor of or a victim of a violent sexual crime. It really doesn't go into, you know, what some of these women who did actually manage to survive, like what they went through, not only, you know, in the trauma and the recovery process, but like how they were treated by law enforcement, how they were treated in court. You know, this is, you know, I, in some ways I don't love how like this, this kind of like old footage of like women's lib is kind of used as a segue into like, but it was dangerous for women.
Yeah. I was a little bit, in terms of how the series is structured, I guess I understand that Berlinger and the editors are like, this is absolutely a vast topic, and you could probably get 4 to 6 episodes out of even like a single slice of Bundy's life and crimes.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think they're trying to stick to their organizing principle and not get too into the aftermath or the sort of the sexist assumptions or biases that may have affected law enforcement's approach, or like, I think there's a, you know, 10-part series just in his legal self-representing antics in court. But I was a little bit, I thought that they should have taken maybe a stronger point of view stance on Carol Duranche being taken apart in court, since she is the one who escaped, at least in the, you know, the non-Florida part of his career. She is the one who fought like hell and managed to escape.
And had the balls to then go and testify against him, look at him in court, and, you know, and her, his defense team called her immature and an immature and unsophisticated girl. Just like also just like the, you know, the angle against her just has to be that she's just a girl and therefore like not qualified to have any kind of like sense of memory or reaction to a grown man, you know, which is just like because they couldn't slut shame her. This was the like route that they went. I mean, they really didn't examine just like what it means and what it took to like, you know, to like identify him in a police lineup and then identify him in court and tell her story.
And just even if she hadn't done that or managed to do that, what it has been like for her. I did enjoy this segment where she's just talking about her life at the time and talking about her bitch in Camaro. And she gets this like faraway look talking about the car. And I was like, that's my girl. Like we could hang out. And that car was fucking sweet.
Yes.
Fucking sweet. Not to get off topic here.
No, but, dude, she was the way she described her life before Bundy, but that year, I forgot it was about Bundy. I was like, oh, tell me more about this awesome year.
Yeah.
Just, and like, then nailed like rock and roll 70s vibe.
And then and her eyeliner and her like Hesher hair, like she I knew people like her growing up, totally. And she's rad. And but then she has had to live her whole life. Like, I think initially maybe it wasn't such a strong sense of survivor's guilt. And she doesn't really talk about this. She just sort of glances at it. But I think there's a documentary to be made about her and about the process of realizing that in this horrible, dark constellation of kidnappings and attacks that she was the one in the Western United States who got away.
Yes.
And that it's like, why me?
Yes.
And that's not really touched on. Again, I understand that Berlinger has what he feels is his job to do, and he's trying not to go down too many side streets from the main journey. But this is
a heavily male-told story. Like, it, you know, from the reporters who interview Bundy to Bundy basically narrating this entire series from the recordings that they took, you know, to the director's eye. I feel like, you know, this is a pretty, like, mansplainy situation for a story about a man who committed crimes against over 30 women, you know, murdering over 30 women and then profoundly impacting several others.
Yeah, I do wonder, now that we're talking about it, how this might have looked different if, for example, Liz Garbus or Aaron Lee Carr had directed it. Actually, Aaron Lee Carr, if you're within the sound of my voice, anytime. Like, I will watch anything Aaron Lee Carr makes, but...
Oh, she's amazing.
If you want to take a run at old Ted, you probably don't. But there, when you say mansplainy, that sort of leads me into my next clip package, where there is a lot of... like discussion of or presentation of aspects of the sociopath that this could just be because I am a little bit too well read this particular section of life, but I was like, I don't necessarily think that we need more on what sociopaths are and how Ted Bundy essayed those things. I mean, here's clip four, which is a childhood quote friend whose tone of faint disdain for Ted Bundy is an interesting choice, talking about how a la Herve Kleckley's famous, this is a carefully constructed reflex machine comment, that there was just something missing in this assemblage that was supposed to look like a human personality.
Nobody really got to be close to Ted. I don't remember him dating anybody. And at the time, I thought it was really terrible because he was a good looking guy.
It wasn't that I disliked women or afraid of them. It's just that I didn't seem to have an inkling as to what to do about it. I honestly can't say why.
He just didn't seem to be all there, all present in some way. There was just a gap in him.
I mean, we know, some of us have reread, especially the postlude to Fatal Vision, like 15 times. Like we know, we know what a psychopath is. I'm going to play this next clip. And then Piper, I would like to ask you about your general impressions prior to watching this of what of like received wisdom about Ted Bundy's childhood life. So here's clip five.
When I asked him about that, he says, oh, that was no problem. That didn't bother me at all.
Yes, of course, this illegitimacy issue is, for the amateur psychologist, is the thing. I mean, it's so stupid. That just bugs the shit out of me. I don't know what to do about it. Or how many people are, in fact, find out that they're illegitimate or even adopted at a later age? It's normal.
Denial, 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 denial. To me, that was a big red flag.
The prison psychologist hoped so much that he himself would be responsible for opening Ted Bundy up for the world to see what was ticking inside Bundy's obviously devious mind.
Okay, maybe I have this wrong, but my impression was that his mother had been on the hem of sex work. No?
The thing that I also was just like, wait, did I miss something? What I heard, but like, or read pretty thoroughly was that his mother was raised as if she was his sister.
Right.
So like, it wasn't that he was adopted or that he didn't know he was a bastard child. It was that the entire time he was thinking his mother was someone and his sister was someone and their roles were actually different. And that was the messed up part.
And that was a prison psychologist who is sort of chuckling ruefully throughout his talking head interviews about how in what contempt Ted Bundy held him. And so I was interested by how resistant Bundy was to this analysis. But right before that, I think it's this psychologist, but it could also be some other expert, is saying that Ted Bundy's mother had him at a home for unwed mothers and then left him there. And Ted Bundy's grandpa made her go back and get him.
Yes, yes, yes.
And if he knew that, that's just like ruinous to the formation of correct attachments for a child. Like, yeah. How do you... Yeah, and then he sort of discovers this later in life. But this was, I thought, weirdly underplayed given the direction that this series went.
Yes, especially if just like, if you want to talk about like the psychology of psychopaths, like... I also want to talk about the whole like nature versus nurture thing and like the like early attachment and not being like held by a mother and how that can potentially impact like your development of empathy, which is something they talk, you know, of like there's some new stuff that they could have kind of gone into that we've like learned about since like Child of Rage that I feel like was actually just kind of generic. Instead of exploring this stuff.
Yeah.
Again, Ted for his weird word. And maybe that was kind of the goal is to kind of like, be like, well, he's not wrong there. Or to kind of like find yourself siding with Ted and then be surprised of like, wait, that's Ted Bundy. Maybe that was the goal.
I mean, there were also parts like the guy that we heard from in our opening clip is the guy who sort of got these tapes because he went to interview Ted Bundy in the Florida State Prison in 1980. And basically, Ted Bundy was just like refusing to admit that he'd had anything to do with anything. And the only way to get him talking was to be like, well, what if, you know, tell me as a psychology major, what is your analysis of this type of personality and type of offender? And that gave Bundy the fig leaf to talk about his actual crimes because he could do it in the third person. So,
which is very OJ. Remember OJ's book?
Yes.
Which is like, if I did it.
If I did. And then that Fred Goldman et al. Like sued the publisher so that the word if is in like a 6-point font and you could barely see it. Go ahead, Fred. But yeah, like he rages. I love that guy.
Yeah,
but
totally.
The thing that you have to take as a given before anything else when you're talking about serial killers is that they're compulsive liars.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, but I think that part of it is not. There are some comments from this reporter about, you know, his frustration with Ted and like that he was sick of Ted trying to fuck with him and et cetera and so on. And that, you know, you never really know how much truth you're getting with this guy. I'd have liked a little more on that. Like, we heard from enough of Ted Bundy's attorneys, all of whom were extremely careful not to exactly say that their client was guilty. Like, motherfuckers, are you kidding me? Like,
yeah,
he did this shit. Come on. Yeah. He's been dead 30 years. Give me a break.
Right.
But then there's the, and I also, I'm always the most interested for some reason. I don't know what this says about me, and it's nothing good, I'm sure. I'm fascinated by the escape attempts, plural, not least that plural.
Oh, that's my that's like my favorite part of this story, which is there's maybe a better word for favorite. But yeah, of just like what two times he escaped from jail and just like not like. Like there's an aspect of Ted Bundy because he's like not a big dude. He's like kind of, I think this is like the core of why people are obsessed with him for so long is that like, there's something very shapeshifty about him that, gives him this like kind of villainous superhero quality. So, you know, he's able to change the way he looks real quickly and just like startlingly, like nobody can really exactly remember what he looks like because he's so normal looking, but also of just like his escapes from two different jails, and like one is through a hole that my cat couldn't fit through, you know. I like don't understand how he did it, and he manages to like pass several states and start a new life. Like they only catch him again because of the sorority in Tallahassee, like because he can't help himself from murdering women.
Well, and like, even then he got pulled over because he had a busted taillight in a stolen car.
That's right. It wasn't even, they weren't looking for him.
Yeah. Even though he was decompensating, like he was time zones away from where he was supposed to be. And I don't think they were necessarily looking for him, even though he's clearly decompensating and he has stolen another VW bug. Like how smart are you again, Ted? Please tell us. But they do talk again about that aspect of sociopaths, which is that their understanding of and feelings of fear are not like ours. I'm always interested in my own reaction to his escape attempts. And this is something that I was talking about in the last episode when we were talking about these skyjackers, one of whom like disappeared into the Swiss countryside and she was never like heard from again, like she's still at large.
Wow.
Hashtag where's Kirkow. But there's this conflict, I think, sometimes in the true crime consumer that like you want crime contained, but you also want there to be the possibility that people can get away with it. Like you want to see them get away with it for a while and then that's enough. And Ted Bundy's escapes, I think, address that pretty directly. But there's also that aspect of him that's not really relatable by us because we're not psychopaths. Anyway, here's clip six.
This kind of boldness that we see from time to time in this personality is probably just being willing to take risks, or perhaps not even seeing risks, but just overcome by that boldness and desire to accomplish a particular thing.
To understand how he thought, you have to be able to project yourself into a sociopath's brain. If you can do that, more power to you. It's a point of pride with me that I can.
Well, yes, thanks. Okay. Same. But I'm always interested in, yeah, you know, like at least try to sort of put yourself in the shoes of someone who doesn't understand the fear of pain or death the way that we do.
That's it.
Do you know what I mean?
Of just like, yes. I feel like there's two ways of like looking at some of these kind of classic psychopath stories. And one is to be just like, he was evil. That is it, you know, and just to kind of like very black and white it, which I'm always just like, I don't care about that one.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
I want to know what it feels like to be missing like something in, what is it, your like frontal lobe, like that you just don't know what fear or empathy is. Like, I want, and of course that's something that like we, you know, as much as like the like, you know, psychiatric community has like evolved somewhat on that, and we know that like psychopaths exist among us, like it's still just like a psychopath like checklist that we're using to determine you know, like who lacks a certain empathy and might, you know, do things that are outside of the norm and potentially dangerous for us. So I guess part of it's also just that we don't know, and people are afraid to take leaps to imagine because it would seem too sympathetic to the villain, which is like, that's not it at all.
Yeah, exactly. Like we are, I think we're trying to, like my grand unifying theory of, being sort of attracted to true crime stories is that you're trying to control things that can't be controlled by knowing as much as you can about them. Like, I mean, art heists, not really, but
yeah, no.
If you read enough about serial killers, then part of you, I think, is trying to arm yourself with as much knowledge and power through knowledge as possible. So
yes.
If I'm going to sit with Ted Bundy for 4 hours again, I'd like a little bit of newer insight into, or just, I don't know, a slightly different point of view on the received wisdom about sociopathy that I feel like been getting for 40 years in this genre. It's not necessarily new.
Yes.
All of that said, like there are things that I would have liked to see more of in this series, but overall, I was captivated by it. I thought it was very well done, and the missing pieces are just because I wanted it to do more and be more.
Yeah.
That's where
I'm coming from
with it.
You can't capture Ted Bundy in 4 episodes. I could do a good 12 episodes of watching the story of Ted Bundy. And then we were talking before we started taping about how I started to deep dive into articles from the 80s when he was executed in 89 about some of the survivors, you know, the women who were in the sorority in particular. Where he murdered 2 women, the other women who were in the sorority that night, who also helped, you know, put him away, who were also deposed by him because he was representing himself.
Jesus.
They had to go see him, and he had the right to question them. And, you know, and they knew at that point, they were like, he just wanted to see who he didn't get to kill. But I mean, this, it turns out that like these women were kept apart from each other in the aftermath. They were not told what happened to their sisters that had passed away. They were told to keep silent about the murders because it would taint the sorority name. Years, they had survivor's guilt. They were not given anyone to talk to, any kind of like treatment. And there was actually a suicide from one of the women who lived across the street from the sorority because she was so traumatized by what had happened.
And, oh my God. And everything
was so, it was such a repressed culture, and these women were treated like little girls, you know? And at the time, the way we treated children was just like, don't talk about it. Just be quiet around them and tiptoe and don't let them talk about what happened and they'll forget it.
Well, and so, also I think our understanding of what is included in trauma was very binary and narrow. So no one's getting the help they need in that regard. We'll have a couple of links to that, to those materials in our show notes this week. I said before that there could be another whole like 3 or 4 episodes just on his legal maneuverings. And I will say that this miniseries does come down pretty firmly on the side of Ted Bundy not only being a vicious, lethal sociopath, but also an asshole. Like, he's not just evil, he's also a dick.
Yep.
Let us begin with him being like, I'm not going to get out of this elevator. When he is being read the indictment in Florida in clip 7.
Gentlemen, I'm not going to be paraded to Mr. Starr's defense. Step out, Mr. Bundy. What do we have here, Ken? Let's see. Oh, it's an indictment, all right. Why don't you read it to me?
You're up for election, aren't you? Mr. Bundy.
You got it, didn't you?
Mr. Bundy.
You told him there you were going to get me.
He said he was going to get me,
okay? You've got the indictment. It's all you're going to get. Let's read it. Let's go.
First of all, he's not restrained at this time.
Oh, no.
Like he's
just
in
walking around.
Yeah, but he could totally have like Jack Ruby'd some cops and suicided by cop if he weren't incredibly vain. But this is somebody who is furious that he is no longer in control of the situation and the narrative, and he's flapping around like a junior in like the high school drama club who has not been blocked properly. Oh my God, he's so pissed, and it's so it really is very diminishing of him to include this footage, which I appreciated.
Yes.
But as much as I like to see like law-splaining little shithead have to sit there and listen to the indictment being read to him, this was a lethal, vicious, sick fuck. And I guess this is where I should warn prospective viewers. Like, we've already seen the whole thing. It can get a little stern in terms of the visuals at times. There is there's like a couple of crime scene photos that involve the remains that were found in the mountains that were a little startling. Like, I'm not super sensitive to this stuff, but it, you know, there is some gore. But the series averts its eyes, I would say, quite pointedly from some of the, the necrophilia. Let's just put that out there. Did you feel that they should have, there is no verb that I can use that's not revolting, explored? Yeah. You know what I mean. Do you think they should have got into that more?
I think that it was strange that it felt like such a footnote. It came at the, you know, came at the very end and was like, oh, and also this happened anyway, which I was just like, oh, back up. Like, because we really, I mean, if this is anything, and I'm not sure what this is, except I do have a theory, but like, I'm not sure, we talked about like what the voice or the take is on Ted Bundy aside, you know,
right,
that's new. If there is a take, it's like inside the mind of, because he, you know, so much of it is narrated by him on these confession tapes. So what I want to know is like more about that, of like, what did he tell people? Why did he do that? Why was that something, why was that an aspect of his, violence, and how did he feel? There's something, I mean, this is going to sound weird, but there's something about the fact that he, you know, acted, you know, as if he didn't remember who all of these women were, but the fact that he obviously did and went back to them and kind of like in a weird way, like tried to like have this relationship with their horses. You know, of like, there's of just like, is that his version of fondness and romance? Like, I need to understand what would compel someone to, you know, to like keep revisiting this awful thing you've done. You know, and then also like in that vein of just like, I wouldn't mind a little more on his relationships with living women too, which they cover a little bit of, but.
Well, and then there's apparently that's going to be the focus of an upcoming project, which I do want to talk about. But before we do that, our last clip from this section is one of his attorneys describing the painstaking cross-examination of law enforcement about the crime scene at the sorority house. And everyone comes right up to the edge of saying that he had an erection in court. But I think that's the implication. And then at the end of this clip, Bundy comes as close as he may have felt safe in coming to explaining that the violence is the relationship. So... This is all pretty euphemistic, but if you have any familiarity with the case, you're going to know what everyone's talking about. Here's clip 8.
Asking him to relate in excruciating detail what you saw when you first got there over and over again, it could be perceived that he had encountered the crime scene before and relished in what it looked like and wanted it repeated. Is how it could be interpreted.
Can you describe the exact position, as best you can recall, of Miss Levy's body as you saw it when you first entered the room?
It's actually repetition.
He's previously described it.
Recall the position of her arms.
If we recognize that the person of this type could receive a gratification in the act of killing itself, it's reasonable to assume that at a later point he might dwell on that because it might fit into the fantasy structure.
I mean, you do wonder if they would have eventually caught him on the sorority attacks just because he had not been able to take any of the victims and store them in a national park for related activities. I mean, this is someone who, like, he took trophies from them, and there was, I understand, physical evidence that would lead to the conclusion that he had tried to have a relationship with them, which I think your use of that particular word is advised and correct. Like, I think there was a part of him that could only relate to anyone on this like silent, dominated level. But yes, that last clip, the fact that nobody would just come out and be like, we at the defense table were horrified that our client, in describing the dead bodies that he had created, or listening to this description by the cops, got a boner. Like, I'm positive that that's what happened. It's so gross. Ugh.
Ugh. It's.
You're so welcome, demented. Everyone. Classiest podcast on the internet. Sorry.
Oh, God. Oh. Bundy.
Yeah.
There's too much, which leads us to something that you were leading to, which is like the reason why I think that he made this documentary is he's researching his narrative feature.
Yes.
The director.
What I thought that was going to be out already. This is the Zac Efron as Bundy.
Yes.
Right?
Apparently, I checked an update. And it's premiering at Sundance in 2019.
Oh, so like now.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. So I'm interested. So that's apparently focusing on Bundy's girlfriend, the first one who actually called the police on him because these women went missing in Lake Sammamish Park and they were looking for a man named Ted. And she called the police and was like, my boyfriend's kind of weird and his name is Ted. And
she wasn't the only one who did this, which I don't think I realized, but I do remember watching The Deliberate Stranger a few years back. And I think it's Glynis Johns who plays Liz in that. And this role is just impossible. Like it's very difficult. And she does a really great job. And actually everyone does. It's still quite affecting that miniseries. But I don't think I knew that this project, first of all, I didn't know it was Berlinger. Second of all, I didn't know that it was more focused on Liz. So that makes it more, that makes it more interesting to me.
Yes, absolutely. Which may be why he's also just like, I actually did delve into like the man or even like the woman's perspective on the man, but he's like trying to kind of keep it all a little bit contained and just give you this overview, this kind of sterile overview in these four episodes, because, you know, he just wants people that are younger to have like a primer on Ted Bundy, because people like us, for this series is like enjoyable as it was for people like you and me, Sarah, are just like, tell me something new. Of just like, we've already done our research.
Yes. We've gone through the whole checklist. With that said, I think it's good for people who, like, everybody knows who Ted Bundy is, but they might not have come up with, you know, the Ann Rule and stuff like that. I think this is a good general overview. I think it gets pretty much everything in. And I, as much as I wish that there were a little more perspective from the victim side, from women's, like, there was enough women's law enforcement represented, I guess, given the time and the fact that there were like two lady detectives in the entire Pacific time zone at the time.
Right.
Sigh, do better, 70s. But I'm sympathetic to the issues there, and I'm definitely looking forward to this next scripted project, because I think it's just easier to get an emotional handle on this story by following the people in it who are people who have emotions that we can recognize. Because at the end of the day, like, you're never going to get to that. Like, the tiniest nesting doll in the middle is not accessible to us because we're not psychopaths. So,
yeah, that's right.
But yeah, I tore through this in a day. I thought it was quite good. Berlinger's a pro.
Oh, yeah. I mean, let me be clear of just like, I had only had access to episode one at first, and I like madly was emailing Netflix in the middle of the night being like, I need all the episodes. So it's a good watch.
It is, for sure. All right. Moving on to our cold case. This was also suggested by Piper, and I will just give sort of, I guess, the case file of John Belushi's death and the prosecution, or is it persecution, of Kathy Evelyn Smith. Here is said case file. When John Belushi overdosed on cocaine and heroin at the Chateau Marmont in 1982, it took all of 10 minutes for high-profile friends to back away from admitting any ancillary responsibility. And not much longer than that for Kathy Evelyn Smith, a sometime backup singer, drug procurer, and Rolling Stone / Levon Helm satellite, to blunder into the spotlight for injecting Belushi with the drugs that killed him, possibly because she was too high to get out of her own way. Contemporary accounts of Belushi's demise and Smith's role in it betray not just what you might call an incomplete understanding of narcotics and addiction, but a sexist eagerness to find a Yoko to blame for bringing a great man down. Smith eventually did 15 months for her role in Belushi's death and was deported back to Ontario, where she still resides. Not to Grimsby, Ontario, but the ABC interview we're discussing today is the mayor of Grimsby. It is Roald Dahrk. Piper, this topic was your suggestion, and I have to say that even though I've read that SNL oral history like 5 times, and I slogged through Bob Woodward's Wired years ago, I don't think I'd ever heard of Kathy Smith, or I don't remember the name. I certainly didn't know Hollywood had like formally scapegoated someone for Belushi's untimely death. What has got you preoccupied with this case? Tell me more.
Well, I too read Wired and really enjoyed it. And I thought that Kathy was a compelling character because Woodward does interview her pretty thoroughly towards the end of the book. And it ended up, you know, I ended up just kind of searching for her backstory and learned that her backstory was really as like a teenage groupie. And that's something that like hits a special dopamine drip in my brain where like 70s teenage groupies I think have been like misportrayed as these kind of like, you know, muses that like got a chance to get really close to the stars, you know, and then just fade away and disappear once, you know, they're not teenagers and ripe and beautiful to, you know, these older rock gods anymore. And Kathy Smith, you know, who was with the band of Bob Dylan's The Band, touring with them as a teenager, and whom several questionable things happened to her that could be described as abuse and abuse of power. She was also with Gordon Lightfoot, who she describes in her memoir as abusive.
Admits to that, and possibly only because she was like listed as a co-respondent in his hideous divorce. But his like most famous,
which is basically a song about like if you're with someone else, I'm going to beat you up. It's a good song, but other than that, it's very disturbing. And you know, and then cut to she's a woman in her mid-30s, and you know she's been given no opportunities. She originally wanted to play music, you know, as many of us did as young people. And if you were a boy, you were encouraged to be in a band, no matter how good you were. And if you were a girl, you were not encouraged to be in a band. You were encouraged to go see the bands. I guess the thing about Kathy Smith and what really kind of got me going is that I started to notice this trend specifically in music. But also John Belushi at this point is also kind of like a comic rock star. But the young women, and they're usually very young, who are with the famous men when they're found dead, are usually blamed by fans for not taking good enough care of the men that were found dead. So we see that with Keith Moon and the young woman he was with when he was found dead of an overdose. You know, we see that even currently, like today, with like the overdose of Lil Peep, and a young female fan was being doxxed and kind of outed on the internet for potentially giving the musician drugs that were laced with fentanyl. But, you know, again, these are all stories of, you know, famous men who tragically have an addiction that is theirs, you know, and they're not necessarily being quote unquote murdered by the women that are around them, you know,
Well, and I thought it was interesting that, you know, I think that if this overdose had not been fatal, LAPD would have been content to just be like, okay, well, be more careful, everyone. Belushi. And once they've sort of interviewed Robin Williams or Robert De Niro, and I don't know whether either of these gentlemen was actually present or when or where.
We know they were present the night before that they all hung out with him and she was there.
Yeah. But they're like, LAPD is not going to be like, so Robin Williams, this one's on you.
What drugs they were doing, if any, but they were all hanging out together at like Chateau Marmont.
Right. Well, and I think the cultural understanding of exactly what they were doing.
Yeah, we know that there were other people there, including some pretty well-known celebrities. I don't think he died. I know he didn't die until he was alone. There is evidence, that she was reportedly shooting him up that entire week, not because, she wanted to shoot him up so much, but he was afraid of needles. And so the speedballs he was doing, she was helping to facilitate, but that was her role. I mean, she was also like a housekeeper for the Rolling Stones, and she was just like an on-call kind of nurse, which was something she kind of described herself as, to the Inquirer. I mean, two things. I think that the LAPD actually were going to kind of leave it alone because there was a lot of controversy around the LAPD at that time, and also just drugs and famous people and Hollywood kind of wanted to keep everything quiet.
Exactly.
But then she gave an interview to, she was given interviews left and right, and it wasn't, nobody was helping her be like, you need to get sober and also not do public interviews. And then she gave this interview to the Inquirer that they kind of framed as like, I did it, which I think was probably taken out of context and more of a like, yeah, I feel responsible. But she was extradited from Canada and brought back to LA. And at that point, her feet were really held to the fire.
Well, yeah. And I think that the sort of larger understanding in the culture that if she had not injected him, he, being John Belushi, would have found someone else.
Yeah.
To do it, because that's what addicts do. And this is not a judgment of him, but no. I think what we didn't know about narcotics and addiction is very evident in this introductory voiceover that is describing some aspects of Belushi's autopsy in clip 9.
The maximum drug jolt called speedballing. The Los Angeles police investigation found that on March 1st, 4 days before he died, Belushi and a female friend stayed up all night drinking wine and inhaling cocaine through the nasal passages and injecting the drug. The female friend in the report is traced to the actor's final day of drinking and drug use and was the last person to see Belushi alive. Kathy Evelyn Smith spent those final hours with Belushi. She was taken in by police for questioning on the day his body was found. She's known as a backup singer for rock groups and a groupie.
I mean, rock groups. Inhaling cocaine through the nasal passages. Oh, that inhaling cocaine. But you forget, like, this was not long after it happened. This is 1982 still, and people didn't. I mean, I feel like actually people did know. I feel like I knew, and I was 9, but I guess they like Mr. and Mrs. America and all the ships at sea. This is how you take cocaine. But there's definitely that, and a groupie, like, just very. It just wants to distill her down to only that thing and dismiss her, but then also blame her for what happened to Belushi, which is there an argument to be made that she should have called an ambulance and then made herself scarce if she felt the need? Yeah, I think you could argue that. But to sort of put all this weight on her, I think is not fair.
You can't make the argument that she should have called because by the time she arrived, he was already found dead. The police were already there.
Okay, so I guess I mean he was like,
oh,
you know, shallow rests, and she made him get up and have a glass of water, and then she left. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean he had shallow breathing, but he was sleep. He was waking up and sleeping. Look, she is a heroin addict at this point.
Yeah,
he's been doing tons of drugs, and so has she. You know, he's not ODing in the way necessary. You know, according to her, and this is all we have to go on, he's not ODing in that very clear-cut vomiting, you know, unconscious way. He just seems to be sleeping. This is according to her. And certainly,
right,
you know, yeah, who knows if her impulse would have been to, like, call the police or call one of his people. And, you know, we also know that, like, you know, a lot of times if one of his people comes over, they don't necessarily want to call the police anyway.
Right. No, I'm not trying to, like, blame her for, like, this
right.
was probably going to happen given the, you know,
yeah.
the life cycle of his addiction. And if she woke him up and, you know, gave him some water and was like, I an experienced drug user and
yeah.
administerer, am content that he's not going to die. I mean,
yeah.
I get it.
Yeah.
What, like, it doesn't matter. It turned out how it turned out, but
it did. And
yeah.
and look, she didn't make it any better in, you know, the subsequent days and months after his death. You know, there's a Rolling Stone article where she sounds
Oof.
Very, you know, she sounds really out of it. She also sounds kind of callous about his death.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the same time, if you read that Rolling Stone article closely, you'll see that, you know, the male author, the first thing he describes are her, quote, flabby thighs.
Yeah,
which is something
what?
That comes up, like, her physical appearance comes up both in Wired and in other accounts of her, which is, why was John Belushi hanging out with someone who looked like that? Which,
because she was a junkie. I mean,
beautiful.
She looked
or technically
bad in this ABC interview, but not, you know, not unattractive, just like she's there with her attorney who should not have permitted
yeah.
this interview, period, because this is the dictionary definition of glassy eyed and high.
Yeah.
And some of the things that she's saying, like her explanation for why, on top of the nearly a dozen speedballs he consumed in a 24-hour period, he was also guzzling wine by the bottle,
yeah.
is just, it's, my heart broke for both of
yes.
them, because this is what my husband would call jokey bullshit. I mean, like, bless her heart. It's the disease, but it really is just like, oh, God, like, do you hear yourself? No, you don't. And your lawyer should put a stop to this.
And he's just using her as, like, a show pony for himself. You know, it's like
yeah.
more men kind of weirdly taking advantage of her. And her whole life has just been to, like, kind of trust these guys and, like, serve them. You know, that's, like, literally how she made, like, a living or had a roof over her head. She wasn't allowed the same opportunities as men because women weren't until, you know, and still aren't, basically.
Yeah. Where was I? Was it in the Rolling Stone article that they were talking to her then roommate?
John Ponce. Yeah.
Yes. Who was like, I don't know. She cleaned up around the house. She seemed nice.
Yeah.
Like,
yes.
Oh,
they,
I mean, and just
it.
Like around them, the shit around the margins of fame.
Yes.
Especially with women who basically have grown up and had this this situation modeled for them as their best hope and only use.
Yes.
And it's just shitty. And listening to that, like, the Rolling Stone article has this angry, I think, contempt for her, but is very evocative as to the extent of her alcoholism, at least in that piece. And you can really hear right here that this is a person who, like, you're talking to the disease.
Yes. Yes.
The person is not in there, and it's really not, like, just everybody's being
ethically, it's like
exploited. Yeah. Oh, it's awful. Here's clip 10.
He was working on a screenplay that had to do with vintage winemaking. So he was drinking wine, California wine, particularly. And he found several kinds that he really liked, you know? And he went for those, and that was the name of that thing. This club closes at 2. We left there maybe 1:45.
Yeah, 1:45.
Went back to his hotel room. And,
Did you drive or he drive?
I drove.
You drove.
Uh-huh.
Did he not want to drive, or was he able to drive?
No,
from the
I
wine?
Just figured I'd rather drive a Mercedes and let him have all the action.
I mean, like, when we make jokes about, listen, you know what your problem is? That's her. She's, like, unable to get out of her own way / the culture's desire to find some particular living person, not Belushi, to be like, This is why Belushi died. And here's another thing that is not creepy to me, but it's like striking in a way that bothers me for reasons I can't articulate. But the recurring theme of people reassuring Judy Jacklin, Belushi's wife, I don't remember the status of their marriage at that time. I think her whole deal was like, you're in a self-destructive cycle in Los Angeles and I'm leaving. I'm not sure if that's true. The number of people who are at pains to reassure Judy Jacklin that Belushi was not fucking Kathy.
Yep.
Like, oh, right. Because it's not possible for the situation to be either more nuanced than that or much simpler than that. Namely, he wanted drugs, she could get them and inject him with them. That's the relationship. Ugh. I mean, I sort of didn't know where you were going with this topic, and then I got completely sucked in and went back and reread parts of Wired and like was sort of Googling around, and then I was looking up Patty Darbinville, who had a very similar trajectory, but it worked out differently, and plays her in Wired, which we will link to that in the show notes as well. It's just,
I have this one thing that's just like, it's goes back. So like I ended up buying Kathy Smith's now out of print memoir, which came out in 83 before she was actually sent to prison, but when she was, you know, after Belushi died. So of course the cover of her memoir is John Belushi. But she, you know, it goes through her childhood and it goes through a lot of her kind of teenage traveling and romance with Levon Helm and the band. And this one thing happened that I had heard about as that kind of like rock and roll classic lore. And that in fact, members of the band are like, oh yeah, this happened, which was that they got, they were crossing the border and they got charged with possession of weed, which was a very big deal, you know, in the mid to late 60s, you know, as they were trying to get like long haired kids, catch them and get them in prison.
Scare them straight.
Straight, yeah. Exactly. So basically, and this is Robbie Robertson talks about this, and Rick Danko talks about this, where they decide that Kathy, who's like kind of in love with Levon, but she just kind of travels with the band, is 15 or 16 years old at this point, possibly even younger, is going to is going to perform sex acts on the old man detective who is going to testify against them in court about the fact that they had possession of drugs. And so she does. And, And so this is, and the amazing thing is, like, both Rick Danko and Robbie Robertson, when they recall this event in, like, many rock biographies, which are all kind of contextualized as, like, them crazy kids in the band, Robbie Robertson and Rick Danko get her name wrong.
Come on, man.
Yep. And they
it's the least, it's literally the least that you could have done.
The least they could have done. And then in her book, and so, and they, and the quote is like, how about our dear Katie? Didn't she come through or what? And then in her book, in her memoir, she says the deed was done at the West Point Motel and the less said about it, the better. For days afterward, I felt unclean. And that's it. Of just like, which to me is just like, oh, this is the first scar of like many for this woman who's just been like doing favors for these guys because she's a kid and she doesn't know any better and she wants to play music and she's been discouraged.
Oh, and who knows what is going on at home?
Oh, yeah.
That, I mean, I was the least worldly 14-year-old that you can imagine outside of, like, who is not named Yoder, okay? And it just, so I'm trying to imagine what, you know, what combination of wanting to be a musician and be, you know, be in that world as a creator, but also what is driving you out of your family of origin to settle for this handmaid's role in all the implications of that word.
Yes.
I mean,
yes,
it's crazy. And, you know, and she's still around.
As far as like, she is, she is, you know, Wikipedia says that she lives in Maple Ridge, British Columbia. But I don't know, you know, the thing that occurred to me, she's got to be in her 70s now. And according to some, you know, very unreliable commenters' accounts, she's, you know, she still struggles with addiction. I don't know that for certain, but she was arrested after she got clean in prison. She was arrested, in Canada years later, for possession of heroin. So it obviously has been a lifelong struggle for her. She would be in her 70s now, but you know, the thing that I wonder is like, will we know when she died? You know, like will it matter, to people? And I wonder that, you know, if she was the one that had overdosed the night that, you know, in the Chateau Marmont, Jean Belushi lived, if we'd even know about it now.
Yeah. I mean,
it might have been covered up. We might never have even known she died. She could have just quote unquote disappeared.
Yeah. Collateral damage, which you seem to find littered around every so-called genius somehow.
Totally. Totally.
Oh, boy. Well, thank you for bringing that story to my attention. You were not joking that it's dark, but especially on the heels of surviving R. Kelly, which we talked about a couple weeks ago, it was interesting parallel. Let's say that.
Oh, and that I just want to say that is like a masterpiece. That is like that really covers every angle that series, which I'm a little late to the game, but I just finished it yesterday. So,
yeah. Let's hope there's a part 7 that covers his arrest, trial, conviction, and burial, head down in a hole filled with bees.
Damn straight.
On that cheery note, Piper, plug your stuff. Where can people find things that you are working on / have written?
Fabulous. Well, my true crime memoir, it's called You All Grow Up and Leave Me. You can find it at your local bookstore or online, on Audible, on Kindle, the works. It's called You All Grow Up and Leave Me. It's a part true crime about an incident that happened in the 90s in Manhattan with my tennis coach, who turned out to be a deranged child stalker who built a cabin in the woods and attempted to kidnap one of his students. And that's not all. And some of the book is an exploration of my 14-year-old brain at the time, which was very taken with this tennis coach and was somehow felt rejected when his intentions came out and I was not the target. So it's part coming of age narrative and part true crime reporting. And I've been told it's a page turner. So
it is. Can attest. Who reads the audiobook? Is that you?
Oh, no. No, I was strongly dissuaded for good reason. it's this woman, Brittany Presley, who is quite good, actually. I listened to another memoir that she did just randomly and loved it. So it was hard to listen to my own one. So I haven't really heard her speak out on mine. Listening to her do another memoir, I was like, oh, I like that. Yeah.
What else are you working on? Anything?
Yeah, I am working on a book, a novel, my first novel, which is very difficult. And it happens to be about groupies. So this is the great tie-in and why I'm very obsessed with Kathy Smith, among other women, both then and now. And what their relationship is to the classic and contemporary rock stars that we seem to, you know, allow to do anything.
Oh, man. All right. I'm excited to read that, too. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
I love you. Thank you for having me.
And please come back if you think of anything else that you want to talk about. We are standing by.
You know, I will.
Coming up on The Blotter Presents, Toby Ball on Netflix, Pot Doc series Murder Mountain, Mark Blankenship on A Very British Scandal, Kevin Smokler on The Onion Fields book and movie. Until then, if you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, you can find me on social media. That's Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter. You can email me at bunting@the-blotter.com, and you can become an official Blotter tipster at the Patreon page, patreon.com/blotterpresents. If you like the podcast, please tell a friend and rate it on iTunes. If you don't like the podcast, keep it to yourself. My guest has been Piper Weiss, and she's on Twitter @PiperWeiss. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.